Okay, so it looks like a few more people have arrived, so we'll go ahead and get started here. So first off, welcome everyone. Thank you so much for joining this afternoon. You are here for the Fulbright Scholar in Residence final last call. So this is our last webinar of a long series of webinars that we've held beginning early summer, late spring. And we've really enjoyed hosting these webinars over the course of the season. And with our upcoming deadline of November 1st, we wanted to be able to be on here to mainly answer questions that you as potential hosts may have. So before we get into it too much further, I just want to make sure everyone can hear me all right. So if you don't mind chatting into that chat box on the right-hand side of your screen, then that would be great, just to let me know that you can hear me. Great, thank you so much. So as most of you have already seen, you can enter questions along the right-hand side there. You're welcome to write in questions along the way as we go through the material today, but then at the end, we're going to be reserving as much time as we can for a Q&A session. And the session is also being recorded, and it will be shared within usually about 3 to 5 days, so you'll get an email from us with a link to it. And again, just feel free to submit questions throughout. And I know that a number of you submitted questions beforehand, so we'll also be getting to those. Okay, so my name is Kaylee Atwater. I'm a placement advisor at IIE, the Institute of International Education, and I work on the team with the Fulbright Scholar in Residence program to help potential hosts through the application process and then into the next steps as well. And I'm joined today by Susan Mundell, and Susan, I'll let you introduce yourself also.
Hi everyone, I'm Susan Mundell, I'm the Assistant Director for Fulbright Multi-Regional Student and Scholar Programs. I'm very happy to be here and thank you for joining us today.
And then we also have the pleasure of David Levin joining us today also. David, would you mind introducing yourself?
Sure. Hello everybody. I'm David Levin. I'm with the Bureau of Educational and Cultural Affairs of the State Department and work on a number of programs, including Scholar in Residence, and thank you all for tuning in.
Okay, so if you're here, you are hoping to apply or you are applying or in the process of applying to host a Scholar in Residence through the Fulbright Scholar in Residence program. So I know that sometimes we do have potential visiting scholars on the line. And if you're in that category, then you're welcome to listen in. But we definitely recommend that you put a U.S. institution that you might be interested in working with in touch with us or direct them to these webinars also. Okay, so as mentioned, the goal of this session is to provide an opportunity to answer your questions about the application process. We'll try to answer questions in tandem with the presentation, especially any specific questions related to the application platform, since I'll be doing a very brief walkthrough of the application website. So during today's session, we'll provide a general overview of the program. We'll be getting some programmatic insights from State Department's perspective, thanks to David. We'll be looking at trends within the program, application resources, and then attributes of a successful proposal. So if you haven't already, I would definitely encourage you to go back and review our archives from other webinars on the FIR website, which you'll be seeing linked to throughout this presentation. So the previous webinars, they provide more detail into the program, and the first six were co-facilitated by previous and current Scholar in Residence host institutions and by peer review committee members and even a few scholars themselves. So they were wonderful, wonderful resources that we could kind of pick their brains during the presentation and see how the application went in practice and also the program in practice. And then just a quick note, as I had mentioned, that the Scholar in Residence program is institutionally driven. So for any visiting scholars on the line, if in case you've joined since then, note that the resources and topics that we're talking about here are geared towards the potential hosts in the United States. So without further ado, let's get started here. So the Fulbright program was established in 1946 under legislation sponsored by Senator J. William Fulbright. It's now well past its 70th year, but it's still vital to the changing U.S. higher education landscape. It's foundationally a public diplomacy initiative, and it's meant to facilitate international exchange and establish mutual understanding. So, and if you have attended any of our other webinars with the other Fulbright programs also, you'll be hearing that phrase, mutual understanding. And along that line, Fulbright is a big umbrella program, and many programs fall under it, and one of them is the Scholar in Residence program. So under the larger umbrella, we're sending U.S. academics and professionals overseas. We're bringing scholars and professionals from abroad to the U.S., and it's sponsored by the U.S. Department of State's Bureau of Educational and Cultural Affairs, which is where we have David joining us from, and it's administered by the Institute of International Education, which is where myself and Susan are coming from. Okay, and then David, can I hand it over to you for a brief discussion about diversity and inclusion and how that relates to Scholar in Residence specifically?
Sure, I'm happy to talk about that. So Scholar in Residence is, I think, unique among Fulbright programs in a couple of ways. One, as Kaylee mentioned, it's institutionally driven, which is unlike most Fulbright programs where an individual applies to study or conduct research, or to teach or to consult. In the case of Scholar in Residence, it's institutionally driven, so it's based on the application that comes in from you as the U.S. institution. The other thing I would say in terms of diversity and inclusion, the program is, in general, it's broad. We have 8,000 Fulbright grants in a given year to the United States and from the United States, and as I mentioned, a whole range of possibilities. Open to almost everyone. We pride ourselves on that. Really, a broad range of opportunities. Fulbright Scholar in Residence is a bit different in that we're actually targeting institutions that have traditionally been under-engaged or less engaged in hosting individual scholars, as well as institutions that are defined as minority-serving. So in a sense, we're giving preference to those kinds of institutions. We talk about minority-serving institutions. We talk about community colleges, small liberal arts colleges, community colleges, schools that perhaps are typically less engaged in international exchange, international education, and serving the minority students who may have had less opportunity for global engagement. So because of that, we're giving a preference to the kinds of institutions that I just mentioned.
All right, perfect. Thank you, David. And you'll be seeing components of everything that David was just talking about through the rest of this presentation also. And that really is the main premise and priority of the program, is reaching those underserved populations too. Okay, so jumping into a little bit more about the Scholar in Residence program itself. As we've been saying already, it's really a wonderful opportunity to bring scholars and faculty members from abroad to campuses that might not have the opportunity to host scholars, or they might not have a strong international presence, so everything that David was saying. And these scholars teach primarily undergraduate academic courses under the FIR program, and it's for either a semester or a full academic year. So the Scholar in Residence is helping to internationalize campuses and curriculums. They sometimes develop exchange courses moving forward, and other outcomes and impacts could be virtual exchanges or online courses, MOUs that are developed, and other elements like this to further research collaboration too. So the Scholar in Residence is intended to provide a cross-cultural international perspective for the whole campus, and even for the greater community. So while there are over 900 Fulbright visiting scholars on campuses around the United States at any given time, what really sets this program apart, the Scholar in Residence program, is aside from the fact that the institutions drive the process, It's that these scholars are highly integrated into the campus and community life. You'll see that if you spoke with someone or listened into a webinar who had hosted in the past or was a scholar in residence in the past. And you'll be seeing this as you look through the application guidelines, as you're working through an application now too, which I'll be showing you in a minute. And these scholars are often teaching full course loads and should be engaging within the campus culture too. So oftentimes we like to say these scholars are viewed as all-stars, and they tend to be more visible than other visiting scholars that you might have interacted with before or from what you do know about the program otherwise. And again, this application is made by the interested U.S. institutions, and the application opened in March. It has a deadline of November 1st. I'd say don't think that it's necessarily too late to start an application. We do have a great deal of resources available, and we're also available to help and talk through the process for either this year or the next or the one after that. I can jump to the next page here. And this is a list of institutions that are served by the Scholar in Residence program, and this is everything that David was talking about earlier. So you can see that this program is really targeted at institutions that have infrequently or maybe never hosted a visiting scholar on their campus, or they serve underrepresented audiences such as Hispanic-serving institutions, HBCUs, community colleges, and so on. We also welcome institutions to partner with other institutions in the area and submit a joint proposal. So we do frequently get questions about if you're not on this list, are you still eligible? And the answer would be yes, but we would definitely encourage you to apply jointly with another institution in the area. And David, would you mind actually talking for a moment about the program benefits, possibly in terms of how the institutions can interact together and what the host and home institutions may learn from each other too?
Sure. So as Kayla mentioned, this program is again unique because the whole notion is internationalization on campus. So the proposal that you're writing is driven by what are your international goals, long-term, short-term, and how can the Scholar in Residence program help you achieve that? So we're talking about, as Kayla said, undergraduate teaching. We're talking about engagement across campus as broadly as possible with students, faculty, and staff who are not necessarily engaged in the actual courses that your scholar might be teaching. And then we talk about community outreach. How is your scholar engaged with the wider community beyond your campus? It lends itself to sort of a whole range of connections that you could make with other institutions, with community organizations. Part of that internationalization, in fact, is what you can do even after your scholar in residence leaves campus. We talk about sustainability, and Kayla will mention that later. It's one of the things we look at in your proposal. So we want to know, for example, how will you further the efforts of your scholar in residence, what your scholar has achieved after the scholar returns home. So maybe we're talking about online teaching by your scholar residents after they return home. Maybe we're talking about student-faculty exchanges between home and host institutions. So there's a range of things that you could do that will further the objectives of your scholar residents even after your scholar has returned home. But that notion of internationalization, partnerships, connections, so forth, it really is at the heart of what we're trying to do here.
Mm-hmm. Thanks again, David. Okay, so now what you see here is a very brief review process and timeline. And one thing that we like to mention is that an added benefit of the Scholar in Residence program that you don't often see in other programs is that we allow and actually encourage institutions to submit draft proposal materials that we can review and provide feedback on. These were due on October 1st, and we really enjoyed working with the institutions that did submit draft materials and working through our feedback with them. But we're more than happy to have phone calls with anyone on the line now who may have missed that deadline, or if you want to bounce ideas off of us via email too. So definitely reach out to us and let us know. And if you're thinking about doing it for the next year or the year after, then just so you're aware, there is that opportunity to actually submit the draft materials to us. Let's see. And then we do have the due date, as we've already mentioned, of November 1st, 2019. And after that, we conduct a brief technical review, and we want to ensure at that point that all of the components are included. So our goal during technical review is not to nix anyone or not to render someone ineligible. We instead want to be making sure everything is there and everything is clear so that we can present all information possible to the review committee when they meet. We then release the applications to our external committee. So you can see that in the next part. So that's in December. And the review meeting is in early December, and it assesses the proposals. And then after the committee is completed, we will send out notifications to the institutions that have applied, and those come out typically in January. After this, Department of State and the Fulbright Foreign Scholarship Board, or FFSB, you can see that up there too, they review the recommended proposals. And at that time, IIE is confirming institutional funding and commitments with the host institutions that were selected. There's a lot that's happening at the same time here, I know. And then in January to around April, we're working to confirm either named scholars or we're working to recruit scholars abroad. If you are in the category of requesting a scholar recruitment, then that's also the period of time when we provide host campuses with any recruited scholars for their consideration and review and confirmation. And with the recruited scholars, we do send candidate information to you to make the final decision as to who best suits your campus and your goals. And then finally, from April and on, we issue the grant packets to the scholars once we have all of those approvals in place. So there are a lot of moving pieces there, but we're definitely happy to help work through now, pre-application deadline, and also later on. Okay, so, and Susan and David, feel free to jump in at any point also, but I can also keep moving through here. And so now we have the review criteria on the screen. So once you click submit on that application on or before November 1st, you might be curious as to what the external review committee is looking for during the review. So that's the group of people meeting in early December. So what the committee is doing is really reviewing to ensure that all the pieces of your proposal are working together and giving them a clear picture of what you're hoping to accomplish through hosting a scholar in residence. So they'll review those short-term and long-term goals. They'll be making sure that a scholar in residence is well-suited and that there's a need and an impact for that scholar on campus. So one thing that we recommend that you think about, since this enters into the review committee conversations, is they're looking at if the proposal is feasible within the time period, what types of community outreach and engagement there are included in the proposal, since, as David and I were saying, it's one of the key components of the program as a whole. So they're looking for to make sure the campus support is there and that it won't be benefiting just one course or one department, but that there will be far-reaching impact within the institution itself, too. They're looking at the sustainability element, so are other professors sitting in and learning about what the scholar in residence is teaching and how can they help sustain it after departure, everything like that. So this review criteria here appears in great detail in the application guidelines that I'll be showing you in a moment too, so you'll be able to kind of see it in effect once we look at those guidelines together. And on that note, we have this application resources page here, because remember, when we send this out within those 3 to 5 days, you'll be able to actually click into these links and access the links that I'm going to be running through here. So I'm just going to switch over quickly to open up our website. And Susan and David, if you have any input, then feel free to make it here while I'm making the switch too.
Actually, Kaylee, maybe now is a good time to pause and take some questions if we have any that have come in about the program or about the review process so far.
Yep, perfect. Thank you, Susan. Okay. Okay. So, David, this may be one for you. Someone is asking if the scholar in residence is primarily teaching undergraduate courses, or can they also teach language courses, or what restrictions might there be on the coursework?
So we say primarily undergraduate courses, which means it's not automatic that that's the only thing we would do. Every year we do fund a small number of proposals that are in fact teaching graduate level courses, but the primary objective is undergraduate level classes. In terms of foreign languages, we generally suggest that not be part of this program, and that if you actually want a foreign language taught on campus, that you actually look at something called the Fulbright Foreign Language Teaching Assistant Program, which really is geared more toward that. There have been a few cases where the scholar residence has taught a language, and we've said that that's permissible, but we would want the scholar to do more than that. So we'd want them to be teaching other aspects of the culture, the society, the country from which they're coming from. So even in the cases where SIR is supporting some foreign language activity, we would want the activities of that scholar in terms of what they're teaching to be more than just foreign language instruction.
Okay, and it looks like we have another question about coursework, this time asking about the minimum expectation for the development of new coursework when compared against bringing a cross-cultural perspective to existing courses. I can start that one off, and then I'll hand it over to either Susan or David here, but I'll say we've seen it in a few different ways. We've seen it pan out in a few different ways with successful proposals. One thing I'll mention again that the reviewers are looking at is project feasibility. So if you are asking a potential scholar to develop 3 new courses for one semester, and they'll need to be creating the syllabi and working with the different departments to make sure that everything's up and running, then they're looking at that from a feasibility standpoint too, whereas sometimes we also have co-teaching opportunities or lecture series also. So we really have seen it take its course through in a few different ways, and a lot of it is dependent on the individual institution and what their needs are. David, did you have anything to add about that too?
Sure. I think in cases where we're actually asking the scholar in residence to develop a class, what might happen is typically that might be, let's say, during the second semester. So the first semester they're actually developing the coursework, the course itself, and second semester perhaps teaching it. So what that might mean then is during the first semester, maybe their teaching load is a little bit lighter than normal because of the fact that they're also developing this new course. I think that we probably see on average a scholar teaching a couple different classes per semester, although in some cases some schools might say maybe they'll teach one class and maybe they'll do guest lecturing in the first semester, in other words, a little bit smaller caseload because it may take them a little bit of time to become more acculturated into your society and in terms of the environment on campus and so forth. But as Kaylee said, it really is determined really primarily on obviously what's feasible, but what you think your needs are as an institution.
And if you have more questions about that or how it could pan out for your institution specifically, then, again, you're welcome to reach out to us, and we can work through it that way, too. Okay. So I will jump back into our website here. One moment. Okay. So if you're not familiar with the website, you can just go to cis.org. And then under the programs here, your U.S. institution who's applying to host a scholar in residence. So we access it this way. This overview tab here, this has these priority institutions that we had talked about. And then if you open up this resources, this has all of the archived webinars. So if you click into that, you can listen in or view the PowerPoints for all of the webinars that we've held thus far. And of course, we're in our very last one here. And then I'd encourage you to take a look at the other tabs here, but the one that I primarily use for advising purposes, if we have a call or if we're emailing, is this application tab. I have this saved on my own laptop, the application guidelines. This is going to be the most helpful resource as you're working through. And this is, again, where you'll see all of these different components that we've been talking about and all of these different program priorities in application form. So I'll just jump through here quickly. So this just has more information about the application form, which I'm actually going to show you in a moment, and then about the individual uploaded components. So what we have here is what the application will look like for you if you haven't been in there yet. You're opening a scholar in residence application. These are the preliminary questions that they ask you to answer. And then in these first few sections here, these are mostly just getting more information about the basics of your institution and what you're looking for in applying to host a scholar in residence. So this will mostly be drop-down boxes, or you'll be entering very brief text. And then later, there will be asking for you to upload materials. So again, because we want to save as much time as possible for questions, I will just run through this quickly. And if you really want an in-depth look at the application process, then we have a different webinar that you're welcome to watch now, and it goes through every component of the application. So this here is just asking for more basic institutional information. If you're applying as a joint proposal, then you click yes, and it will ask you to enter this information twice, one for each institution. The institutional contacts here, we ask you to indicate who the responsible administrative official is. So this is a person who is signing off on behalf of the institution saying, yes, we are able to welcome a potential scholar on campus, and this is one. And then down here, there's the principal contact for academic arrangements. So sometimes these two people may be the same person, which is completely fine. And when we get into those uploaded documents that I was mentioning, you can actually break down who's responsible for what, who will be interacting with the scholar, and in what capacity. But here we're just asking for basic information about each of those contacts. Then we jump into program information. So, of course, we want to make sure that the dates are falling within 2020 and 2021, since we're looking at next year now. Financial support. We are just asking here for basic amounts. So there's the option to indicate salary supplement, and then there's also the in-kind support. And before I go in further, since we do get questions about this frequently, David, do you mind just touching on it now, how financial support comes into play with the program?
Sure. It's one of the ways that we ask you to demonstrate some commitment to the program, but you should realize that it's not a requirement. We're not going to disallow your application because you weren't able to come up with some kind of salary supplement, but we do ask if that's feasible, and if that is, that's great. If you can't do actual cash, which we understand will vary campus to campus, maybe you can do some kind of in-kind support, whether that means perhaps assisting with housing on campus. Maybe it means providing a dining hall meal ticket. Maybe that means providing some support for your scholar in residence to perhaps go to a professional conference with their American faculty colleagues. So think creatively about ways that you might be able to assist that scholar in residence, whether it's cash, which is great, or whether it's some kind of in-kind support while your scholar's on campus.
Mm-hmm. Perfect. Thanks, David. Okay, and then it's just asking for more basic information also about your institution. And then down here we have the proposal summary. So this is used by the reviewers to get a quick snapshot of, and they do use this to see what at its core your proposal is requesting or what you're proposing a scholar in residence would potentially do while engaged on campus. And then we have the scholar profile section here. This is where there are two different routes that U.S. institutions can take. You can either name a scholar or you can request scholar recruitment. If you are requesting scholar recruitment, you'd click no, and then you're able to select two countries from one world region that you can request scholar recruitment from. I'd say to take a look at our website because there is information about, if you see here, this region's countries participating in SIR. So you can take a look there at what the country breakdown is by region. And then I could talk for a very long time about named versus recruited scholars. So what I would say is take a look at the application guidelines, especially when we get into those uploaded sections, which, again, I'll be talking about in a moment. There's a great deal of information about those two different routes and I'm almost there. So what we're asking for if you're naming a scholar and what we're asking for and what the reviewers are looking for if you're requesting a scholar. So all of that information is here and it's very helpful. So if you click yes, saying that you are requesting a specific scholar, then you can include all of the information here. And if you clicked yes here, then when we get into the supporting documentation, there will also be a spot where you can include the requested scholar's CV and letters of recommendation. That will not appear if you're requesting scholar recruitment. And then just looking very quickly through this, and again, all of this is in the application guidelines. There is the institutional profile. So that's more basic information about your institution, where you might, and this is where you can really highlight if you have need or what your interactions with international institutions or scholars have been thus far and study abroad programs, everything along those lines. Sorry, I know I'm scrolling quickly through the guidelines here, but here's the section about the institutional profile. And it can be typically 4 to 5 pages if it's a single institution applying, and then 7 to 8 for joint proposals. And we often recommend breaking down this institutional profile by these subsections, as we find it's really helpful in organizing the material and presenting it to the reviewers also. Then back in the application, you'll see the next section is the proposed program and financial support. So these two sections here, these are really the main essence of the application. And then this proposed program, I'll jump back into the guidelines and show you what the reviewers are looking for here. So there's the oversight, the academic program of the scholar, plans for other campus activities, and then community outreach. So this is showing how all of those elements that David and I were talking about earlier, how they kind of come into play in the application itself. And then professional enrichment for the scholar, sustainability, and then a bit more information that we had already talked about. So I definitely recommend taking a look at that. I see that we had a question about the sample syllabi or the course outlines. So you are able to upload sample syllabi here. And I know that it can be tricky if you're asking for new coursework to be developed and or if it's a lecture series that a scholar might be involved with, so trying to figure out how to present that information here. So again, we have seen that in a few different ways, and what the reviewers are looking for is, again, with feasibility. So if you're able to show if how many times a certain course would be expected to meet, for example, or how many office hours the scholar would be expected to have with the students and really the amount of engagement that they'd have, then that type of information would be helpful. Susan or David, did you have any other input about the syllabi or the course outlines and how they can best approach those components?
I don't think there's a lot more to say. I guess I would just, you know, if you're asking, for example, for a course to be developed, then you would want to have a, you know, succinct paragraph that explains, you know, exactly what would be taught and what the particulars might be. Bearing in mind that you're bringing a scholar in residence here from abroad. You want to be as clear as you can to provide details as to what you want them to do, particularly important in the cases where you're asking us to recruit for you, because the U.S. Embassy or the Fulbright Commission in the process of recruiting is going to design with our help sort of a one- or two-page document that explains specifically what the scholar in residence would be doing and what the host campus would want of that scholar. So that the more clarity you can provide, you know, the more specifics, the easier it's going to be for the Fulbright Commission or the U.S. Embassy to recruit for you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's a really good point. And it is mentioned a few times in the application guidelines, too, that the information that you're including in these uploaded sections is used for the reviewers, yes, but then if selected, this is what we're also using to potentially recruit that scholar, so exactly as David was saying there. And with that sample syllabi or course outline section, this really does go hand in hand with in this proposed program and financial support section here. And again, sorry, I'm jumping back into this. The academic program of the scholar. So you can take what you've provided here in the academic program of the scholar and really expand on it or provide additional materials about the academic program of the scholar in this sample syllabi and course offering section. Okay. And we already talked about if you're requesting scholar recruitment, what you'd include here. Letters of support. This is your way of showing and showcasing the amount of support that is waiting for a scholar. So this really helps reviewers to see, okay, not only has the institution talked about potential connections with the community in the proposal, but here's a letter of support from that community member, from that organization saying, yes, we want to engage with a scholar while on campus. And then finally, we ask for a letter from that responsible administrative official. So this person here would match up with who you had listed in these institutional contacts on one of these first pages here. And that was a very brief walkthrough of the application itself. Susan and David, if you have any input thus far, you're welcome to jump in, but otherwise I will start gathering questions again, if you'll bear with me for just a moment. Okay. And actually, and Susan, this might be for you. We had received a question beforehand about how the visa process takes place and IIU's involvement with it versus the host institution. Would you mind talking through that quickly and what the expectations of the host could be?
Sure. So as a Fulbright participant in the Fulbright program, the visiting scholar will be coming on a J visa, J1 and J2 for any dependents that might be accompanying them. And IIE will prepare the DS 2019, which is the supporting document to obtain the visa, and then coordinate with the Fulbright Commission or U.S. Embassy in the home country of the scholar, who will then assist with the visa application process. So there is no requirement on the part of the host institution, since this process is managed by IIE.
All right, great, thanks. And a lot of that information, we get into the details of it after a potential host has been selected. So in around January and on, our team is really working with you and with the potential scholar on all of these next steps. Okay, and then we do get this question frequently also, but I see it has come in, is if there is a preference for scholar recruitment versus naming a scholar. And then a second part of it is if it's possible for a scholar to engage in research. David, would you mind answering the named versus scholar or versus recruitment quickly?
Sure. It's perfectly fine for the host institution to do one or the other. There's no preference. I would say that typically, if you look at what we get, I suspect that probably 60%, maybe 70% of the requested proposals, the requested scholars are actually named as opposed to requesting recruitment. But again, there's no requirement. One or the other. The one thing I would say, if you are in fact asking for a named scholar, we ask you to provide information for us as to how are you familiar with the scholar, how are you familiar with their teaching skills and abilities, how are you familiar with their proficiency speaking English, because we talk about the fact that they're going to have to have an English language fluency at the level that they're able to teach college classes and give public lectures, so that's important. It shouldn't be someone that you perhaps met at a conference, so that would be great to have on campus, that might be true, but we really want some specifics from you as to how you can specifically speak to that scholar's qualifications.
I also just want to add to that, I think it's important to keep in mind that even if you are naming a specific scholar, it's not a guarantee that that scholar will ultimately be at your institution. It is possible that so the scholar also will be vetted by the U.S. Embassy and Fulbright Commission and the FFSB, the Foreign Fulbright Scholarship Board. And you know, in some rare cases, that scholar may not pass. But in those cases, we'll work with you to either recruit a specific scholar, or perhaps you have an alternative scholar in mind that might be able to fill that position. But for that reason, we do remind you or request that you are flexible in who the specific scholar might ultimately be on your institution.
And I know, so as Susan and David were saying, it can be difficult to walk the line in your proposals, and we understand of requesting a scholar for recruitment versus naming. And to that, I just reinforce that this really is an institutionally driven application. So it's great and wonderful to include information if you have it about a potential scholar and how they would meet the needs of your institution, since you're able to talk about them specifically, but we really do want to be hearing about the needs of your institution also. So again, and I'll keep saying this, you're welcome to call or email and or set up a time to speak with us if you're not quite sure how to address that in the proposal, because it does vary by institution too. Okay, then we did have a question about the how to address in the application or where to address it if you're able to host just a scholar or if you're able to host a scholar plus dependents. Susan, would you mind talking about that? I will say that in the application form itself, you'll just be putting the scholar's information in, but I think that in the uploaded materials, there is room where you can indicate if you're flexible and indicate if in housing, for example, you're able to provide family housing, and in maybe there's language courses that a spouse or children could be enrolled in. So there's a few different creative ways that you can address that for the reviewer's benefit. But Susan, did you have anything else to add about that maybe? Not sure.
Just also to mention that the program will cover a portion of the dependent support. There's an allowance for up to three dependents to be covered. But in addition to that, we can only provide coverage of the flight for the individual scholar and one dependent, I believe the spouse. So in some cases, what we've seen is if there's a scholar, an individual scholar bringing, a lot of children with them, that the institution can sometimes offer support to assist with covering the flights of the children. So that's another form of financial support that can assist a scholar to bring his family.
Mm-hmm. And I know that we've seen successful proposals where a whole family is getting really engaged in the community, and it's been a really exciting thing to see. But I do have that financial support section open on the screen right now, and that's what Susan is referencing too. So this can be really helpful if you're speaking with other departments within your institution about the expectations running how you can be preparing or what you might be able to contribute to the scholar and his or her family. Okay. I am going to jump back into the presentation quickly. Okay, so we had already talked through all of these resources here. These are just links, again, to the pages that I had shown you. And then we do want to mention the Outreach Lecturing Fund briefly here. So as I had mentioned before, there are at any given time around 900 visiting scholars in the United States. These can be from anywhere within that larger Fulbright umbrella. So they could be scholar-in-residence scholars, or they could be research scholars housed in on campus or in labs. They could be conducting research or traveling around the U.S., but they're present in the United States. So the Outreach Lecturing Fund, this allows for you as the institution to apply to host them for short-term lectures. So we view this as almost a nice way to get your feet wet as to what it takes to host a scholar, starting with this short-term basis and then growing. And Susan, did you have anything to add about the Outreach Lecturing Fund too?
It's also just that it's another way to also partner with other local institutions. So the scholar can come to your institution, but also to visit surrounding institutions. And it can either do a lecture or give a presentation, be part of a workshop, lead a workshop. But it's a really great way to expand the internationalization of your campus and provide exposure to your communities for all of our visiting scholars that come worldwide to the U.S.
Yes, and on this page there actually is a link to the directory of the scholars who are in country and where they are and what their specialties are, so you can access that. And then David, actually, do you have any other notes about the Outreach Lecturing Fund too?
I just think that it's very flexible. There's no given deadline date. It's a rolling kind of thing. The process is relatively easy. The lead time, obviously we'd like as much lead time as you could provide us, but certainly can do, give you arrange a scholar to campus within, let's say, 4 weeks or 6 weeks lead time. So that's, I think, a fast turnaround. Think about ways that you could be engaging a scholar. Maybe it's during November, during International Education Week, or maybe something else is going on campus or in the community that would lend itself to hosting this visiting scholar. It's great for you. It's also great for them because we hope that they'll be traveling to perhaps a part of the country they've not been to. Perhaps they're experiencing, by visiting your campus, another kind of your institution, different from perhaps where they're doing their primary fieldwork work. So it really is an enriching experience both for you as the host and your students and faculty, but also for the scholar themselves.
And someone had asked how long short term is when I said short term for this program, and I believe that the suggested program duration is 2 to 3 days. Is that correct, David?
It's actually two to six days.
2 to 6 days, I'm sorry. Thank you. Okay. And then we're jumping to our last page here. So this is how you can reach us. So I know that there may be a few questions that we're not able to get to today. If there are, then please reach out to us at sir@iie.org and use those application guidelines that I had shown earlier. And we have a couple of minutes here, so let me just jump back in and see if we can answer any more questions. And it looks like we had a few more questions about the named versus recruited scholars and what that process looks like. So I hope that we were able to answer those. But I think that we might be able to wrap up in a moment here. I will just say thank you so much for joining today. And if you had joined any of our other webinars, thank you also for coming to those. I know that it's such a pleasure for us to be able to discuss this program and to engage with all of the U.S. institutions with it also. We are very excited to be receiving the applications over these next few weeks here before the November 1st deadline. So again, just reach out to us anytime you might have a question, and we're happy to walk through any pieces of the proposals with you. Susan, did you have any final notes for us before we sign off?
Just to wish you all good luck with the application process, and we look forward to seeing your proposals.
Yeah, and then David.
Yes, thank you for tuning in. I appreciate you joining the webinar. We hope that you're enthused by what you hear and that you can envision the benefits to your campus. So, you know, we encourage you to finish those applications and ask questions of us if need be before you do that. But best of luck with the process.
And then from me, just a final thank you to David Levin for joining us for all of these webinars and being such a wonderful resource for us and for all of the institutions that are listening. And I know that it's really helpful to hear priorities and about the policies from Department of State's perspective. So thank you so much, David.
Happy to do it.
Yeah. Okay, so on that note, we will end the webinar, and we look forward to working with everyone again soon. Have a good afternoon.
Thank you, everybody.